Well, on just about every channel, there's something about Jesus this Easter weekend. His life, his crucifixion. In a moment, Dr. Ken Hansen joins us as we talk about the archaeological work behind the trial of Jesus. Who was this man? Dr. Ken Hansen next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Ken Hansen, author, lecturer, founder of The Treasures in Time. Now, that's an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. He has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in a politically volatile region of northern Galilee, taught Hebrew, and here he is this Easter night on Coast to Coast, Dr. Ken Hansen. Welcome back, Ken.
Good to be back, George, and continuing Easter and Passover greetings from the University of Central Florida Judaic Studies Program.
Excellent. Why are we seeing so many television programs about the life of Jesus? I've never seen this many on any Easter weekend.
Pretty compelling, isn't it? And I think there's a general hunger out there for anything that is spiritual, anything that is religious. Let's face it, the society has turned increasingly secular over the last decades. And that, I think, promotes a hunger in people. People are just curious, they're interested, and they want to experience, I think, something beyond their mundane life, shall we say. They want to expand their concept of reality, and that includes spirituality as well.
The historical Jesus, we are convinced he was indeed a person, are we not?
I think we pretty well are. Now, scholars are certainly apt to debate whether even Jesus existed. But when we look at not only the textual evidence that we have, but the archaeology as well, everything is pointing to the fact that this is a real historical character. Now, I'm a professor, an associate professor in a Judaica program here at UCF Orlando, so I'm not bound necessarily to defend Christianity. I'm certainly not paid to do that, but nonetheless, just good scholarship, and even Judaic scholarship tells us we need to be interested in this man. He was a historical character.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the work of late. Tell us about this archaeological discussion about the crucifixion.
Right. Well, really, it dovetails with a certain experience that I had, and I hesitate even to talk about it, but
really?
I can only describe it as a paranormal experience of synchronicity that I personally had on January 1st, New Year's Day this year in Jerusalem, Israel, with a tour group that I was leading. And I had promised the tour group before we left that I would take them to the site of the actual trial of Jesus. And that alone is pretty astounding because, let me tell you, people go by this site all the time in Jerusalem, Israel. It's right at the old city of Jerusalem. They walk by it, they drive by it, they have no idea what they're looking for, what they're looking at. And we've got the site now. We're sure of it. This is, you can stand where Jesus was actually tried before Pontius Pilate and stand where Pilate stood. Absolutely remarkable. But my experience was this. Now, I'd promised my group to take them there, but to be honest, it had been a few years since I had been to the site. I've lived in Israel for several years. I know the land pretty well. But let me tell you, my sense of direction is not always the greatest. So can I really find the site that I promised to take my group to? I happened to be in Jerusalem one day ahead of my tour group, and I decided I'm going to go to the old city, make sure I know exactly where this fairly new archaeological site is. So I took the light rail system, beautiful new light rail, from my hotel right to Jaffa Gate at the old city of Jerusalem. It was kind of a cold, blustery day, January 1st, and I looked into the old city area, lived in the city. I thought maybe I'll explore a little bit first, but then I thought, no, I'm going to turn to the right, and I'm going to walk along the wall of the citadel, This was the wall built by the Ottoman Turks in the Middle Ages, but it sits exactly on top of an ancient wall that comprised the palace of King Herod the Great. And we're sure that this is where Pontius Pilate would have resided while he was in Jerusalem.
Could you feel anything, Ken, when you're there? Can you feel what could have happened a couple thousand years ago?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And it's even spookier than that, because I'm walking along this wall looking for the site, and I had as a target an image. Actually, it was in my iPhone. It was a film clip of a History Channel documentary that was produced a good 10 years ago that identified the site, the actual site. And in the film clip is a rather well-known British archaeologist named Shimon Gibson. Now, I had never met the man, but I follow this sort of thing. I'm a professor. I had it in my iPhone. I'm looking for the site, and I'm walking along this wall. I didn't see it. I didn't see the site. I promised my group I'll show them. And I got to the top of a little embankment, and I looked over, and there was not only the actual site I'm looking for. You can see the steps and everything where Jesus would have stood. But Shimon Gibson himself is standing there explaining it to a gentleman, just a one-person tour, as it were, one fellow who had hired him to take him to the spot. And I couldn't believe it. If I had been there 5 minutes earlier, Professor Gibson would not have been there. 5 minutes later, he would not have been there. I walked up to him, and it was one of those Dr. Livingston, I presume, moments. Seriously, the most remarkable things that ever happened in my life. And my jaw hung open, and I asked if I could videotape him, and he very pleased. He said, of course. I've documented all this, and I've put it on a Google blog, which in turn is linked to my website, which is linked to the show. And everything is there, exactly how it happened, as he explained precisely the trial of Jesus.
Tell us the significance, Ken, of all of this. What does this mean to us?
Well, for one thing, we can prove exactly that it happened. People normally are taken to a different part of the old city, and they're shown a place called the Antonia Fortress. And they're told that this is the place where Jesus was tried before Pilate. Well, good archaeology has told us for a long time this is, I'm sorry, bogus. It didn't happen there. And the pavement that they are shown where Jesus supposedly stood, it wasn't even there in Jesus' day. It was a good century afterward. And consequently, this famous path that all the Christian pilgrims walk, called the Via Dolorosa, is equally bogus. I'm sorry, it just is not the place. But now we know, in fact, where it did happen. And all of this was completely covered for centuries and millennia. In fact, it's only about 20 years ago that this part of that wall on the exterior of Jerusalem's old city was actually excavated under Israeli authority, brought down further. And that's when another gate from the Second Temple, from Herod's palace, was discovered. Just remarkable. And as I say, people walk by it all the time. And they have no idea what they're looking at. If people only knew, there should be a line a mile long out in front of this place. You can see where the crowd would have assembled. There's an ancient stairway that led up to an actual gate. We believe that it's called the Essene Gate, by the way. We've heard, a lot of us, of the ancient Essene sect who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. Apparently, they had an encampment in ancient Jerusalem, and King Herod, who liked them, called the gate of his palace after them, the Essene Gate. And that's where Pilate would have sat on his chair, as it were. The steps are there, and that's where Jesus would have been brought out of a barracks area. And the crowd would have assembled with Roman soldiers in front and shouted, "Crucify him." Now, there's even more significance, because there's so much misunderstanding about who was responsible for the crucifixion. What was the Jewish role in the crucifixion
Well,
of
I've
Jesus?
always heard the Sanhedrin got him convicted.
The Sanhedrin got him convicted, right? Well, now, who was in charge of the Sanhedrin?
Good point.
It was dominated in those days by the priestly class, who were in turn in cahoots with the Romans. But to be honest, the Jewish people did not have the authority to crucify anybody. And according to Jewish texts, such as the Mishnah and the Talmud, the only type of death that could be ordered by a Jewish tribunal like the Sanhedrin was stoning, burning, strangulation, or death by the sword. Crucifixion's not one of them. And yet, down through the ages, let's face it, the Jews get the blame. The Jews. And they're all just kind of lumped together. And the Jews and the Jewish leaders, the leaders of the Jewish people, the Jewish religious leaders, and that's where it's left, without distinguishing one group from another. The priesthood in those days was in cahoots with the Romans, but they didn't have the power to execute. They had to turn it over to Pilate. How do we know he had the power to execute? And archaeology plays a role in this also, because in the coastal city of Caesarea on the Mediterranean coast, we have another archaeological find that is an ancient stone that actually bears the name Pontius Pilate.
Now, what does that mean, though, for us?
It's the only archaeological evidence that we have that Pilate existed. But beyond
really?
That, the inscription goes on and tells us plainly that he wasn't just a Roman procurator, he was a prefect. And we couldn't be sure of that without the archaeology. It's a slam dunk, it tells us. And a prefect is the one who had the power to execute. It was Pilate, it was the Romans. What about this Jewish crowd? Who were they? They were in the pocket of the priesthood.
And they were screaming and yelling for the crucifixion, weren't they?
Whipped up by the priesthood, by a group known as the Sadducees. We've heard of the Sadducees. But again, people get it all confused. They lump the Sadducees in with the Pharisees, and then we have the scribes and so on. And people don't distinguish. The reality is that in Jesus' day, the bulk of the population would have been greatly sympathetic to Jesus. And even in some of the films, it's very badly depicted. You just get a nondescript group of Jews out there shouting for his death. And let me tell you, this has had huge impact over the centuries to feed into this phenomenon we call anti-Semitism. And it's really sad because the Jews get the blame. Who are the spiritual and, in fact, lineal descendants of the Pharisee party today but today's rabbis, rabbinic Judaism, the Jews who lead our services and our synagogues and temples to this day? And yet they're all lumped in with this nameless crowd shouting for the death of Jesus. In fact, the rank and file of the folks back in those days were greatly sympathetic to this man who was a healer. He was a miracle worker. I believe he was part of even a larger group who were constantly in tension with the priesthood, constantly in tension with the Roman Empire, and I think ultimately threw in with a rebellious cause that culminated in a huge revolt against the Roman Empire, but part of a larger spiritual current that some scholars have referred to as the visionaries. And they included the likes of not only the Judeo-Christians, but the Essenes, whom we just mentioned, and various other groups in antiquity, the Bethusians, the mourning bathers. There were visionaries, there were seers, there were miracle workers. We know some of them by name, who were roughly contemporaneous with Jesus. A whole crowd of folks who were seeking, just as we talked about at the beginning, some kind of expansion of consciousness. Our reality needs to be expanded. seeking spirituality.
How do we know that the crucifixion indeed took place?
Well, not only do we have the place of the trial of Jesus, but we're pretty sure we know, in fact, the general area where Jesus was crucified, and that is also from the archaeology. If we had just texts alone, this all can be debated, and as I mentioned, there are serious scholars who doubt the whole story, doubt everything about it.
The whole thing,
but that's
the entire thing.
The whole thing. The whole thing, and even the existence of Jesus, yeah. And
well,
of course, I'm a scholar. I know what goes on in academia, and this is the kind of things. If you have texts alone, how can you prove it? Because the texts are religious texts. We only have the Gospels. We only have the New Testament. Mm-hmm. How can you be sure? Yada yada, right? But when you actually put spade into the earth, and what you find correlates, now you're onto something. And we know the area. Of course, that brings to rise yet more controversy about the tomb of Jesus. We could get
right.
into that. That's also in the news.
We'll talk
the
about that at the
hours.
Half here when we come back, Ken. But if they doubt his existence, then they've got to doubt just about everything. God, the works, I would assume.
Well, in the scholarly community, let me tell you, doubt is the byword. And I think healthy doubt is a good thing. As an academician myself, I'm trained to doubt. I'm trained to
well, you want
ask
answers.
Questions about everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, we want answers. We want things that are well-founded. That's why when I had my paranormal experience, I made sure this. I documented every bit of it. I have photos of it. The chances of my meeting the very archaeologist that I was looking for on my iPod as a target is to me it's impossible, right? And so prove it, right? So the skeptic needs proof, and that's a good thing. We've got it.
When Pontius Pilate convicted Jesus, basically. What happened to Barabbas?
Well,
wasn't that the trade?
Scholars doubt all of that as well, and some suggest that the Gospels are really lying to us, basically.
Oh, boy.
They want to exonerate the Roman authorities as much as possible because Christianity was destined to move west into the Roman Empire, as we know, especially at the hands of Paul. So we'll make Pilate somehow even a sympathetic character who would have liked to release this fellow named Jesus and send Barabbas to the cross. But instead, the crowd shouts, "Give us Barabbas." Well, actually, I disagree with those scholars. I think the Gospels probably got it right there. I think that Pilate, in spite of the fact that he had full power and authority to execute, and he used it in this case, nonetheless, I think he looked at Jesus as someone who basically was not threatening at all, and would have been more than happy just to release him with a good whipping, a scourging. He was recognizing Jesus probably as one of this visionary sect that I mentioned, a diffuse group of Jewish prophets and healers, miracle workers, as it were. And this is no threat to Rome.
All right, Ken, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment, and let's talk about the tomb of Jesus. I want to get your take on something we talked about yesterday, the Shroud of Turin as well. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Ken Hansen with us. We're going to come back and talk more with him about the archaeological aspects of Jesus. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Ken Hansen with us. Ken, what do we know, first of all, historically, about the tomb of Jesus?
Well, the tomb of Jesus is in the news again, and it's as complicated as it is controversial. So I'll probably need your help, in fact, just to make sure we're all on the same page.
Sure.
And that it's clear. So stop me when necessary. Here's the deal. We've got a traditional tomb site that is located at what's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Old City of Jerusalem. We have another site that's revered by Protestants called the Garden Tomb to the north of the old city of Jerusalem. It's a very lovely site. I love going there, but frankly, there's nothing historical about it. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, as dank and dreary as it is, has oodles of archaeology behind it. But what's in the news, and we're talking in the last day or two, is a New York Times piece that has blown the whole subject open again. It goes back to a certain theory advanced in a Discovery Channel documentary that was a big splash back in 2007. It was produced by none other than James Cameron and an Israeli filmmaker named Simcha Yakubovich. And I respect both of these guys. They found a tomb, or actually we're covering in this documentary the finding of a tomb in a neighborhood of Jerusalem called East Talpiot. The tomb was discovered by accident back in 1980. Now, there are many, many, many ancient tombs all over Jerusalem. I've been in many of them myself. Most of them are quite empty. Most of them have already been perused and ransacked long ago. This one, however, was different because there were ossuaries inside. It's where it already starts getting complicated. What's an ossuary? It's a
limestone box, right?
There you go. And because at this particular point in Jewish history, when a person died, they would wrap the body in a burial shroud and lay that body on a niche, like a shelf, in the side of a burial cave. And they would allow that body to decompose over the course of a full year. And then usually family members would come back after the year had passed and all the flesh had decomposed, and they would perform a second burial. Really unique in history, in Jewish history certainly, that they would do a second burial. They'd collect the bones and then rebury them, deposit them in a often ornately carved limestone box, stone box with a lid on it, called an ossuary. And then the ossuary would be reinterred in a single shaft in the side of the same cave. Well, this cave that was discovered back in 1980, this burial cave, contains several ossuaries, in fact, 10 altogether.
Wow.
And there were inscriptions on them. There were inscriptions on the ossuaries. One of them read, Yeshua, son of Yehoseph. Now, Yeshua is the name, Hebrew name for Jesus, right? Another one reads Yose, which may be short for Yehoseph, maybe the brother of Jesus. James Cameron and Simcha Yakubovich looked at these and they found another name, Miriamenu Mara, that they suggested might be Mary Magdalene. And another inscription, Yehuda bar Yeshua, Judah the son of Jesus. Another one, Matya or Mata, that they suggest was Matthew. And then another one, Maria, that might have been Mary, the mother of Jesus. And they're putting all these things together, and they're saying that based on the names alone, we may have stumbled on the family tomb of Jesus.
Now, here's the question. Jesus apparently was supposed to have arisen, right, on the third day.
Yeah.
He's out of that
Christian
tomb.
Tradition.
He's gone, right?
There you go. Yeah, that's in Christian tradition. Of course, the scholarly community is doubting and questioning everything. I'm a scholar myself, so whatever the archaeology tells us, then that's what we go with. But here's the question. Just because we have an ossuary that says Yeshua bar Yehoseph, does that mean slam dunk that this is Jesus, the son of Joseph, the same one in the Gospels? In fact, we know that these names were very common in ancient times. And sometimes it's hard for us to come to grips with how common a name could be. For example, my wife is Russian, all right? And her name is Elena. And I swear, every third woman in Russia is named Elena.
Yeah, exactly.
And her best friend is named Tatiana. And every second woman in Russia is named Tatiana, right? So if you were to go to a Russian cemetery, you'd find a lot of Elenas and Tatianas around. It's the same kind of thing.
But what are the odds of finding them all within one family?
Well, you see, there you go. That's the issue. And the plot thickens even more because, here I told you it's complicated, sometime before that, yet another ossuary was discovered, ended up on the antiquities market in Jerusalem, and picked up by an Israeli fellow who's a collector of antiquities named Oded Golan. This ossuary also inscribed, and it says, plain as day, James, the brother of Jesus in Aramaic, Yaakov Achui de Yeshua in Aramaic, James, the brother of Jesus. That also made a huge splash. But the problem was that it was also doubted. The brother of Jesus part of the inscription, it was claimed, was forged by Oded Golan himself. And the poor man was, in fact, brought up on charges before an Israeli court. And for years, this case dragged on because there is a huge forgery industry in archaeology going on in the Middle East. And he was accused of having forged the inscription, right? Finally, he was exonerated, although still it's doubted by many whether the inscription is authentic. Nonetheless, the case couldn't be proved, and he was exonerated. Now, I mentioned this because I told you, not only is it complicated, but 10 ossuaries were found in the so-called Jesus tomb, all right? However, we now only have 9. One of them went missing. And the
How could it go missing?
Well, because in the science of archaeology, artifacts are collected, they're brought to the central holding place, as it were, and everything that's valuable is promptly cataloged, but if a piece really is deemed in no value to it at all, it can even be discarded. And the archaeological report said that the 10th ossuary was broken and bore no inscription and was really worthless, and they just threw it away. However, I told you it's complicated, now the conspiracy theories arise that in fact the 10th ossuary was not thrown away, it is the James ossuary, which if you add to the other 9, now you've got a cluster of names that's almost irrefutable as the family of Jesus. But you have to connect the James ossuary with the other 9, and how do you do that? Well, on just a couple days ago, as I mentioned, the New York Times piece has reported something new. There's an Israeli geologist named Ariyesh Shimron who's been working on this, and he's identified a geochemical match between specific elements present in the Talpiot Jesus tomb ossuaries, including the ossuary of Jesus himself, son of Joseph, and the James ossuary. He says they're a match on geochemical basis. Magnesium, silicon, iron, same components found in both ossuaries. And now they're claiming we've proved that this, in fact, is the missing 10th ossuary. So,
I mean, that's dramatic stuff, Kenny.
It sure is.
Hugely dramatic.
Yeah.
Now,
hugely dramatic.
If it's indeed the tomb of Jesus, that means the story was correct, that he was crucified, they put him in there. However, we still haven't proven that he had these incredible powers, the powers to rise from the dead, to do the things that they said he did when he was living.
Mm-hmm.
Or
and
do
all
it.
Of that would be impeached if this find is in fact correct, and that we have now the actual burial box of Jesus of Nazareth. Can you imagine that? But wait a second. I told you it's complicated, and we're talking about serious archaeology and serious scholarship now, and it's our job as scholars to doubt everything. You have to ask questions. You don't just accept things with no questions asked. You get in a lot of trouble that way. So on re-examination of the Jesus burial box, that first name, Yeshua, isn't really clear, in fact. It's very badly inscribed, and it's been suggested that it might, in fact, have been superimposed over an earlier name. And as far even as this new geochemical match is concerned, Oded Golan himself, he's the fellow who was tried for forgery for having forged the inscription of the James ossuary. You'd think that if anybody were interested in connecting his ossuary with the Jesus tomb, it would be the said Oded Golan. But he has even piped up within the last couple of days and says he doubts it. In fact, he says that if you wanted to prove such a match, that you'd have to have a much larger sample of the elements. You would need to test some 200 to 300 caves, burial caves in the vicinity to prove that on the basis of just the chemistry that the James ossuary and the Jesus box go together. So there's doubts all over the place about it. Furthermore, this isn't the only incidence we have of clusters of names that seem to sound like they're biblical. We've got some ancient papyri in an ancient settlement on the south end of the Dead Sea that has a cluster of Jewish household names in this ancient papyrus. Follow that so far?
So far.
All right. The names include Jesus, Simon, Miriam, and Jacobus and Judah as a
Huh.
cluster of family names, one family. In a papyrus on the south end of the Dead Sea. Well, nobody thinks that this family was the biblical New Testament family. They're in the wrong place. It's not the south end of the Dead Sea. That's not Jerusalem. This is not the New Testament family. But just by chance, you've got a cluster of very similar names that happen to appear in the New Testament. So the names themselves don't prove anything in terms of this being the actual tomb of Jesus. And I think that sincere Christians who would like to believe that the tomb was empty ought to take heart in that. But there's something else that I think is way important and for some reason hasn't been mentioned in all the
And what's
coverage,
that?
and
What
that
is that?
is location, 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 as in real estate. Where is the East Talpiot tomb located? Well, I know East Talpiot. It's a suburb of Jerusalem today. It's due south of the old city. Actually, it's just over the Green Line, technically, into the east side of the
How
city.
close to Mount Calvary, where the crucifixion apparently took place?
Well, that's the issue. Where did the crucifixion take place? If we assume that the crucifixion was either the site of the Garden Tomb, which I don't think it was, or let's say the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where most archaeologists believe it was, we're talking about miles and miles of schlepping, as we say in Yiddish, that you would have to carry the body of Jesus from the place of crucifixion to the Talpiot tomb, unless you want to say that Jesus was crucified near the Talpiot tomb and not at the Holy Sepulchre at all, which I suppose is possible. But at that point, now we have to say that a man who, now we know exactly where he was tried by Pilate and whipped and scourged, and of course he's bleeding profusely. He's half unconscious. He has to carry this wooden beam, and we're gonna suspect that he carries it miles down the road to East Talpiot. He'd collapse before he got there.
Of course he would. He couldn't
So the
carry it.
location is no. And if he were crucified at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, all the archaeology points there. In fact, it was an ancient quarry. We know this, a first century ancient quarry, and they likely called it Golgotha in Aramaic, Golgotha, the place of the skull. Now, there's no feature of it that looks like a skull, but nonetheless, because people were crucified at a quarry, this is a place that suggested skulls to them. So the Holy Sepulchre fits exactly. He could easily have, well, not easily, but he could have carried his cross that far. It is quite walkable. I made the trek myself, even on this current excursion of mine, to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That must have been the place of crucifixion. But now he's been crucified, when? On a Friday, the day before the Sabbath, and they've got to get his body all the way to East Talpiot before sun goes down. Good luck. Good luck. So I told you it was complicated, but that's what swirls around the archaeological world, and it's fascinating stuff. And you know, it's changing constantly. You know, there's never an end to it. Just when you think the last word has been said, then some new discovery pops up.
In your opinion, who was this man?
Who was Jesus of Nazareth?
Mm-hmm.
As a scholar, I have to say it's a matter of faith. And professionally, I have to say it's a matter of faith. As a historian, I identify Jesus, and I'm quite serious about this, as an ancient Hasidic Jew. We know we have Hasidic Jews today, right?
Right.
They wear black coats, black hats.
Long hair.
You know, many of them, especially in the land of Israel, have healing powers attributed to them. It's quite remarkable, and some of them have incredible, even messianic followings. There's one Hasidic Jew named Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was the head of...
That was Rabbi Schneerson, right?
Rabbi Schneerson, you got it.
We know all about him.
The head of the Chabad Lubavitch sect organization of Orthodox Jews, still very influential, prominent. In every city, there's a Chabad house. He founded this movement. But word spread that he was and is the Messiah of Israel. And while he died of a cerebral hemorrhage back in 1994, there, I'm told, and I'm sure it's accurate, that there are not a few members of this organization to this day who believe that he will be resurrected as the Messiah.
Yeah, they believe that. It's an amazing story.
That. Now, there was an ancient sect of Hasidic Jews. Most people don't know this. Most people don't know they think the Hasidics, well, that's a modern sect. There was an ancient sect. Now, they did not wear black coats and black hats, but there were healing powers attributed to them. And we know, in fact, the names of some of them. There was a fellow named Honi HaMe'agel, which means Honi the circle drawer, who lived, in fact, in the decades before Jesus came along. There were already these Hasidic Jews. Why'd they call him the circle drawer? Because during a drought, he took a stick, he drew a circle in the sand around himself, and he declared, God, I am not moving, I'm not leaving from this circle until it rains. And the other rabbis were aghast at this chutzpah, they called it. And there were Pharisees around in that day too, and they always squabbled and they fought with each other. That's common in Judaism. But did they try to kill him? No. In fact, one of them, according to our Jewish texts, this is not in Bible, of course, this is the Jewish Talmud, one of them said, Honi, we would have excommunicated you.
Ken, we're coming back. We're going to take calls with you and still keep talking. I want to get your thoughts on the Shroud of Turin as well.